1520 Susan Henley versus the City of Youngstown Board of Zoning Appeals.
The case, we've read the briefs, and
yes,
the case seems to turn on what level of scrutiny should be applied to the zoning ordinance.
Yes, correct.
And the briefs don't mention it for obvious reasons, but since the time that you've briefed this case, I take it that you're familiar with the case that this court has published regarding what test to be used for these ordinances.
Yeah, that's the case that was argued back in October of last year, Your Honor.
Humphrey,
that must have actually just came out because we checked up until about 3 weeks ago with regard to the case.
Okay,
so,
well,
Your Honor, I'm
not
familiar with that.
I'd hoped that the counsel would have checked and been aware of it because it does change your arguments, I think. That case does say that compelling state interest is the... We review state regs that allegedly violate the free exercise clause as whether they serve a compelling state interest.
As whether they serve a compelling state interest.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, I believe that coincides with our argument, however, quite nicely, to be honest with you. Our arguments initially were based on the Smith case.
Smith case, right.
From the Division of Department of Human Resources versus Smith.
Right.
Anywhere a generally applicable law, neutral on its face, but which may impose substantial burden upon the free exercise of religion, should be a compelling interest that should be used to address those types of cases in two specific situations. One where there may be an individualized assessment for that particular zoning ordinance, in addition to a series of exemptions by the ordinance itself. That I believe, Your Honor, is the thrust of our case.
But if you were relying on Smith, then I think that the series of individualized exemptions might make it difference and hurt your case, the Smith, this ordinance does provide that you can apply for a variance, right?
This ordinance does provide that you can provide for a variance, yes, indeed, Your Honor. However, in our situation, accessory use was the proper avenue to go in this particular situation. It's not a variance from the ordinance itself. The system of exemptions, however, Your Honor, lead one to necessarily conclude that a compelling interest test must be used.
It actually doesn't matter now because we wouldn't need to go to Smith for the law, right? Under Humphrey, we don't need to refer to Smith.
Under Your Honor's assessment of Humphrey?
Under the Ohio Constitution.
Yes.
Did you raise the Ohio Constitution?
The Ohio Constitution was raised in this particular brief at this particular time. However, opposing counsel has issued arguments stating that it had not been raised prior to this.
Ooh.
So that is why I am addressing you
Smith.
This case.
Right, then
at
you
this
aren't.
Point in time.
Okay.
How do you explain Section 80 of Article 7 of the Youngstown Zoning Ordinance? It seems to me that you just read the plain language.
Section 80, Your Honor, does provide for a system of exceptions, and that's where we're relying on the Smith case as well. Section 80 itself specifically says, in residential districts, except as otherwise provided in this ordinance. That plain language of that ordinance, Your Honor, specifically states that there are exceptions within the zoning ordinance itself. The sheer fact that there are exceptions would require the court to impose a compelling interest test.
So there may be exemptions, but doesn't Section 80 specifically in subsection 2 say it shall not contain or be used as a dwelling unit?
It says it shall not contain or be used as a dwelling unit, but that particularly is the substantial burden that it's placing upon my clients and upon their exercise, their free exercise of religion. It is that particular section that produces the burden that we are bearing at this point in time and necessitates the use of a compelling interest test. There are exceptions within this specific section there, yes.
So if you're going to put 35 people in there and, let's say, one priest?
I'm not sure what your answer is.
You then have to take the substantial burden analysis? I mean, it specifically says you can't use it as a dwelling unit.
Specifically says you cannot use it as a dwelling unit except as otherwise provided in this ordinance. There are a system of individualized exceptions within this ordinance, Your Honor.
I'm telling you why I went through a number of these kinds of cases as a councilman in Toledo with this years and years ago, particularly when we were putting in halfway houses into residential neighborhoods and houses for people who were mentally disabled, those kinds of things. And they were always very controversial. But one of the things that's always in the statute is that you can't have a single family dwelling containing more than one family.
That's correct.
Now, supposing part of the second family had something to do with the religious concept, would that be a burden? And did you have to go to the higher test then? Even though the ordinance is so specific that says it shall not be used as a dwelling unit.
The use of this particular piece of property is being utilized in furtherance of free exercise of religion. It is the mission of the church. It's an undeniable mission of the church for social outreach as this program is applied. That indeed is what the burden is that we're bearing is number two within the general requirements of Section 80.
Yes. Certainly a very worthy purpose. There's no question about that. The question is, do worthy purposes, no matter how worthy, have a right to negate the law?
I don't believe it's whether worthy purposes, Your Honor. I believe it's whether the free exercise of religion by my clients in doing this and administering the social outreach, whether that particular activity is substantially burdened by this zoning ordinance. And if indeed it is substantially burdened, then it's incumbent upon, in this case, the appellate court to show that the state has a compelling interest and that these indeed are the least restrictive means in so doing that. So it's not just any worthy cause, I believe, Your Honor. I believe it's this particular cause, which is the in furtherance of the free exercise of religion. It's interesting to note as well, Your Honor, that this piece of property, this former convent, with the zoning, with the Court of Appeals decision, could not even be used at this point in time for a convent. which to me seems ludicrous on its face. It doesn't matter whether this program is administering to disadvantaged women and children, or whether the church would like to use this property once again as a convent. The zoning ordinances were enacted subsequently. The zoning ordinances, as they stand, were enacted, I believe, in 1990. The church used this piece of property as a convent until 1993, for 40 years prior thereto.
But it would fall under a prior.
It would fall under a prior
use.
However, there was a period of time within the zoning ordinances, a lapse of more than 2 years, with that prior non-conforming use, which would mean that it is no longer a prior non-conforming use.
Because your argument is, too, that you couldn't even use this piece of property as a parish house for the priest.
That you may be able to do, Your Honor, because there's a specific exception. Again, another specific exception within the zoning ordinances for a parsonage, for a rectory, mm-hmm. for a church.
And doesn't that take into consideration the exceptions you're talking about? I mean, doesn't that... You say the ordinance is subject to such exceptions.
Yes.
Isn't that one of the exceptions?
That's correct.
Doesn't that make it reasonable?
Doesn't it make this particular ordinance reasonable?
Mm-hmm.
Just because it has a series of exceptions does not necessarily make it reasonable or relieve the burden that this particular ordinance places on the exercise of religion in this particular case. The series of exceptions leads to support our argument that the Smith case in this instance should be utilized, because this is one type of case that was contemplated by Smith, a general, neutrally applicable law with a series of exceptions and individualized assessments. In applying for accessory use permit, there was an extreme assessment done by the zoning officer initially and by the Zoning Board of Appeals. Substantial amount of testimony was given at the hearing. The record is replete with the letters of support that were attached as exhibits. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Professor. Mr. Cochran.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I would like briefly to comment on what I am and then move on to a procedural history, because it has some particular relevance to the waiver arguments that I've raised in my brief. The one item I would like to speak to you about tonight, which was addressed by my colleague, and that is that there is an exception for the use of the convent in the zoning laws. There is no such exception for the use of the convent as an accessory building. The use of the convent in R72 residential district, where this property is located, is a permitted use within that district. So you would not need to obtain an accessory use permit for that use. You would be able to obtain a regular permit for the use of that. Therefore, it's not an exception to Section 80's restriction about using an accessory building as a dwelling unit. Also to note that this would not necessarily prohibit the church from using this building as a convent. And I would comment to you about the procedural history, and you'll understand how the church has replatted this parcel during the middle of this case. And it's their replat that has made this convent an accessory building. Prior to that, it was a separate standing structure in a separate lot, and it was an authorized use within the zoning district that it was in.
Mr. Crocker, let me divert you for a minute and ask you the same question that Justice Cook asked opposing counsel. The Humphrey case, have you read the Humphrey case?
I have not.
Okay, so, but the compelling state interest is not a new test. How does that apply to your argument?
Well, I assume you're talking about under the Ohio constitutional provision. And with regards to that, first off, I wanted to note that the waiver argument is still applicable to that. This is the first time that they've raised this argument throughout the proceedings. With my procedural history, they made federal constitutional arguments to the Board of Zoning Appeals, to the magistrate, the trial court, and to the Court of Appeals, and did not raise an issue as to the Ohio constitutional provision until after the Court of Appeals ruled against them. I believe the document waiver should apply, that argument should be waived. Not knowing the analysis of your decision in Humphrey, I was prepared to argue to you today that it was not a wise approach to adopt a compelling interest standard to a generally applicable neutral law. And citing to you the rationale that Justice Scalia used within the Smith decision, and that is that if you apply this analysis to all generally applicable neutral laws that have some bearing on or burden on someone's religious freedom, then every law on the books is going to be subject to challenge. There's going to be no finality. We're going to live within a system of exceptions rather than a system of law. everything from taxation to animal cruelty to children's care, medical issues, everything that exists has potentially got a burden on the exercise of freedom of religion. And I do not believe it's our constitutional history to say that every law that carries this burden, that is otherwise generally neutral and generally applicable, must have a compelling interest to withstand muster.
Accepting for the moment the argument for purposes of our discussion, your argument about waiver on the Ohio Constitution, the question I have then, since we would be considering the Smith case,
yes.
The question I have that I put to your colleague was whether or not it was appropriate to file for a variance here. Counsel says that no accessory use was the point. There are exceptions for variances, and I wondered if that matters to the Smith case.
I would like to address that because they cited to you that because the Section A refers to other except as otherwise defined within the ordinance, they've not cited to you any provision, other provision in the ordinance that acts as an exception to the accessory use restriction about using it as a dwelling unit. Now, when you're applying the Smith analysis, a variance is an exception process. They did not request one in this case, and to be honest with you, under the ordinance, they were not entitled to one. There's a restriction within the Youngstown ordinance that says that you cannot obtain a use variance. A variance is usual property within a district that is otherwise restricted, prohibited within that district. In the R72 district that we were dealing with, multifamily housing was a prohibited use. So a variance would not have been an option that was available to them, nor did they seek one in this case, Your Honor. I'd like to address the court further on this issue about the proper standard of review under the federal law. And then Smith and Warren decisions reiterate that the general rule is no compelling interest is required when you're dealing with a generally applicable neutral law. And they're not contested that this is a generally applicable neutral law. What they've argued is that two exceptions that have been commented on by the courts may apply. One is that system of exceptions exists. I believe that the Court of Appeals correctly noted that there is no exception to the restriction on the use of a dwelling unit on this building. They've argued to the court that you should consider the fact that the decision about what is and what is not an accessory use involves an individualized decision-making process. And my response to that is that may be an interesting issue, and it may trigger strict scrutiny analysis. I'm not conceding that. However, the outcome of that decision is not dispositive of the case, because you still have Section 80 sitting there as a separate provision within this ordinance saying there are no use of the dwelling even as an accessory building. Now, in the alternative to that, or as a hypothetical to explain that, you say the ordinance had a restriction against the use, say a yard restriction, 15 yards off of the property. And say that somewhere in this ordinance there was a provision saying that except a school could have a 10-yard setback. Well, if you take the appellant's analysis and try to use it to that scenario, they would be arguing that because that exception exists within the zoning ordinance, you would have to apply strict scrutiny to the restriction against the use of a dwelling unit, because somewhere within the zoning ordinance there is an exception to some provision. That's not the reason that the exception was created by federal courts. The federal courts created this exception because when the government sees fit to apply a restriction to someone, and then they make a decision saying, accept this group or class, then it's suspicious. They have to withstand the compelling interest standard to say, why didn't we extend this to the group or class of people whose religious freedoms were substantially burdened? And if you take that approach to this, you have to look at Section 80, not the rest of the provision of the ordinance, and see whether or not there's an exception to that, and there isn't, and the Court of Appeals over that.
Counselor?
Yes.
The Court of Appeals seems to say that strict scrutiny is never applicable to zoning cases. Do you agree with that proposition?
I do not, Your Honor. I must confess the Court of Appeals went a little further than what I requested. But I think their analysis in the ultimate decision is still true, still accurate.
Does Bourne say that?
Bourne does say that in a general rule, strict scrutiny is not applied to a generally applicable law. But it does cite the exceptions that the appellants have raised.
Okay, so that really is an extension by the Court of Appeals, is it not?
It was not an argument that I made to them, and it was a step further than what I had requested in Andover.
Okay, now I recognize you think this question probably should go to your learned colleague, but I was curious what your response would be to it. You make, in fact, that's where I started reading Article 7 of the Youngstown Zoning Ordinance when you cited us to Section 80. I find little or no discussion of that in the Court of Appeals decision and none in the appellant's brief.
I'm a little confused. The Court of Appeals did address Section 80.
Well, but only on definitions. Not specifically in any great degree that there shall be no dwelling unit.
Well, I think the Court noted in its opinion that they find no exception to that restriction. And therefore, I think that's what they apply to the law. This gets into a little bit of the appropriate standard review argument I was going to make, but I think what the Court of Appeals did in this case appropriately was on 2506 appeal, which this was, they took the decision of the trial court, they looked at Section 80 and said, the decision here, they didn't apply the appropriate law at the trial court level. And this court in the Granville decision has said within a 2506 appeal, it is within the purview of the appellate court's discretion to make a decision that the trial court did not apply the appropriate law and then to turn around and to apply the appropriate law. So I think what the Court of Appeals did in this case was they took Section 80, they gave it an interpretation, they applied it to the facts that existed, and they decided that the trial court had, through ignoring this argument, had failed to apply the appropriate legal standard.
Are you using the language, according to Appellees, Section 80 was enacted to keep people from living in certain places, and then they say, appellants argue that even if transitional housing is considered an accessory use, it is an accessory use that is prohibited by Section 80, Article 7, because an accessory building may not be used as a dwelling unit. That's the only place I can find any discussion, but that's a different issue, is it not, than a specific dwelling unit prohibition. As accessory building is different than a dwelling unit.
Oh, certainly it is.
And I don't even see them quote Article 7, Section 80 in their opinion. And am I right that I don't see much discussion or any in appellant's brief with regard to that? Was it an issue at the trial court?
It certainly was, Your Honor. I raised the issue that the restriction of Section 80 applied from the time that they... When we got to the master level, the parcels were on two separate lots. I argued at that time that they could not get an accessory use permit because it had to be on the same lot to get an accessory use permit. They introduced new evidence at that procedure to replat the parcels. From that point on, consistently throughout these proceedings, I've argued that Article 7, Section 80, prohibits the granting of use accessory use permit because they were using this property as a dwelling.
Well, am I just missing it? It seems to have disappeared.
Thank you for the indulgence. Let me grab my version of the opinion.
No, it's fine. If you...
I believe that it was in the opinion from my memory of reading it, but it definitely was... addressed.
Of the Court of Appeals opinion?
I believe it was.
It is as an accessory building.
Yes.
But not a specific dwelling unit, I think. But, all right. I look again. But it just seemed to me that's got to be the threshold, doesn't it? Before you ever get anyplace else?
Well, I believe the Court of Appeals would have to have made a finding that it was an accessory building under that definition, and that, therefore, then the provision about the restriction of use as a dwelling unit as an accessory building would apply.
Yeah, but accessory building comes under subsection 5.
Correct.
Subsection 2 is the prohibition with regard to dwelling units.
The dwelling unit restriction applies to an accessory building. So if you take the interpretation of accessory building, then I argue at the trial court level and the Court of Appeals level as well that this was an accessory building without contradiction. So by the time it got to the Court of Appeals, they had already made a decision that...
Okay, that's why it happened. Okay. All right.
Sorry. I wanted to address the court on the waiver argument with regards to the Ohio constitutional argument as well as the hybrid rights exception. Those are two different arguments, but the waiver should apply to both of them. Through the procedural history that I've been trying to announce to you, they picked and choose which exception and which constitutional arguments they wanted to make through this process. And I don't know whether it's the tactical reasons or otherwise, They didn't raise these arguments until now. And I believe that there should be some finality to the trial court decisions, and there should be some rationale and reason why we should put forth our arguments at appropriate times and ask the court to find that they have waived those arguments. In the alternative, with the hybrid rights exception, which is the other exception to the federal constitutional argument that they cited, they are trying to argue that a takings clause violation constitutes a hybrid right. That's never been determined by the U.S. Supreme Court, and in fact, to read the Smith decision, Justice Scalia made a point to note that he wanted to restrict, not expand, the application of the hybrid rights exception. So I would argue they failed to meet their burden to demonstrate that that would qualify as a hybrid right. Even if it would, they would have to have demonstrated some conflict of that right, some violation of that right to trigger the strict scrutiny analysis. And in this case, no matter what standard this court would adopt as to how much they would have to show, they don't have a takings clause violation. And the reason is that they didn't introduce any testimony at the Board of Zoning Appeals or at the trial court level to substantiate that violation. And as a practical matter, they were denied an accessory use permit. The accessory use permit leaves unattended the principal use of the property. So therefore, they could not demonstrate that all economically viable uses of this property would be taken away by the denial of the permit because the principal use of the property is still intact and unaffected. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cocker. Mr. Jurassic, you save 5 minutes of your time.
Just to touch on Bourne, which was an issue that you raised. The issue in Bourne had nothing to do with strict scrutiny or the applicability of strict scrutiny to that particular case. The sole issue that was assigned on that particular case was whether RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, was constitutional or not, and it was found to be non-constitutional in that particular case. Bourne, however, did uphold the Smith holding of compelling interest test to generally applicable statutes with those two exceptions. And it's those two exceptions, actually the one exception that I would like to just address in this rebuttal, and that is that one exception is indeed the section that calls for exceptions and individualized assessments. It is the zoning ordinance taken as a whole which has exceptions and individualized assessments. It is the zoning ordinance in our application for an accessory use permit that individualized assessments were indeed made. When those things do happen, it is incumbent upon the court then to utilize a compelling interest test. There is a substantial burden that has been placed on my clients with regard to this, and it's incumbent upon the court in finding that those things exist, the individualized exceptions and the exemptions, that the court utilize the compelling interest test. The final argument that I would like to make is that the Court of Appeals appeared to err in its standard of judicial review. It did conduct what seemed to be a de novo review. It found that Section 80 was not addressed by the trial court, and I would argue that it would be incumbent upon the court at that point in time, being that the record does not have sufficient evidence in it to make that assessment and make that determination as to whether or not Section 80 applies. It would have been incumbent upon the court at that point in time to remand back to the trial court.
Would that have been a question of law or a question of fact?
That would have been a question of fact to remand back to the trial court as to whether or not Section 80 even applies.
Because of the factual circumstances or because of a reading of the zoning code?
There would have been factual circumstances applied to Section 80. It would have been an error of law that they did not review that particular section, but the factual scenario that was there could only have been found at the trial court for further additional testimony. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.